Welcome to the committee today. Pursuant to House File, House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order. The CLA will take the minutes. When member's name is called on, please say present.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Albright. Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Heintzman. Representative Howard.
Present.
Representative Keeler.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick present.
Representative Crenshaw. Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative Meckland.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative Sandell.
Present.
Representative Sandsted.
Present.
And Representative Thompson.
Present.
Heintzman present.
O'Neill present.
Albright present.
Well, thank you very much. May I now have a motion to approve the minutes for January 27th, 2021.
So approved.
I did not see who that was. My screen went blank for a second there.
Representative Meckland.
Thank you. Representative Meckland moves to approve the minutes for January 27th, 2021. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for January 27th, 2021 are approved. Before we get started today, I just wanted to thank all of our staff, whether they're from the GOP or from the DFL or nonpartisan staff, for all their work and effort this session. We have unusual circumstances and a lot of work goes in behind the scenes. And I want to thank them as well as our House information staff who makes these meetings possible online. So I want to give them a shout out and thank them today. Our presentation today will be with the Office of Higher Education. They will be giving us an overview of the state grant program today. I want to let members know that we will be reviewing the governor's budget in a different hearing in the future. We will be just strictly focusing on the overview of the state grant program today. We have Meredith Fergus, who is the research manager with the Office of Higher Education. Ms. Fergus, welcome to our committee and please proceed with your presentation.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, for the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I'm with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education and I'm the manager of research in SLEDS. And I just want to make sure everybody can hear me okay. Good?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So I've been asked to just give a quick overview of the state grant award formula. And so there's only a few slides here. I will let you know where there are some changes coming. Congress did make some changes in the way the Pell Grant operates and financial aid in general, which will have an impact on the state grant beginning in fiscal year or with aid year 22-23, so about 18 months out from now. The state grant is essentially a mathematical formula, and every part of that formula is actually controlled by state statute, which means it's in your hands. And so the formula starts with tuition and general fees, adds in the living and miscellaneous expense allowance to create the award budget. It then does a proration for enrollment, and then it subtracts out the assigned student responsibility, which is currently at 50%, and assigned family responsibility, which is related to that parent contribution or expected family contribution off the FAFSA. And that is one of the major changes that will be forthcoming thanks to congressional action, as well as—
Ms. Fergus, if you could just hold on for a second. I love your efficiency. I love that about you. And I just, we have a lot of new members, and it's helpful if you slow down so that we can help process the information you're sharing with us. Thank you.
Not a problem, Madam Chair. I am a fast talker. So the state grant formula is on your screen. Each of the components are stated in state law, and we do have the relevant statute for you. And so essentially, once we do this mathematical formula, it does calculate an individual student's state grant. I was mentioning that there are some congressional changes that took effect at the beginning of this year that will impact students in fiscal year 23. And that includes the assigned family responsibility. Because it is based on the FAFSA and the expected family contribution that comes out of that process, Congress has made a change to eliminate essentially the expected family contribution and move to what is called a student aid index, which will have a different calculation. We believe the calculation correlates to the current expected family contribution, but it's less reliant on family assets, and therefore we will see some changes in what students essentially are assigned as their family responsibility. And so we'll have to likely make some adjustments once that change is finalized. In addition, we have the Pell Grant, and that Pell Grant was increased by Congress at the beginning of this year. The Pell Grant will also change in the extent that it will no longer operate off the EFC, but it will also operate off the student aid index. And we are still trying to figure out what those changes mean for Minnesota. On the next slide, we're essentially just walking through the various lines on that formula. And so it starts, of course, with tuition and fees and living and miscellaneous expense allowances. You can see the relevant statute is 136A, 121 subdivision 6. It does state that the allowance is specified in law for LME, and the tuition and fees is the average, or the tuition and average general fees set by a college, but maxes out at the highest public 2-year and 4-year college in Minnesota. So private colleges, if they are 4-year, essentially receive a grant equal to the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, and private 2-year programs receive a grant equal to Normandale Community College. And there's the numbers for the current year. Currently, the University of Minnesota, and the cap for the maximum tuition fees is at $15,142. Normandale is at $6,113. If a college is below either of those caps, essentially the state grant recognizes the amount of tuition that is charged to the student. Living and miscellaneous expense is currently set to 106% of the poverty line. It is benchmarked to poverty. We were previously at 100%. We've managed to make some incremental changes over the last few years. There is still some concern with the LME level, the extent that we're asking students to live a poverty level lifestyle as they go to college and expecting them to succeed. And so it has some pretty big interactions with housing and food insecurity. This is a visual of the state grant formula. And you note that really to get the full budget, you add the two cost components together, which creates the maximum grant within the state grant. If a student has tuition fees beyond the maximum charge, essentially the student and family have to pay for that themselves. So within a University of Minnesota Twin Cities example, we have the assigned student responsibility, which is 50% of the recognized costs, just under 13,000. The other 13,000 is essentially a combination of Pell Grants, state grants, and then the family responsibility. You can see for the University of Minnesota, that maximum tuition falls at $15,142. Actually, it's better shown on the next slide. This is what a student sees. So essentially, financial aid is processed in which Pell Grants are applied against their tuition bill first, then state grants, and then the remainder is to be paid by the family and the student. And so as you move up, you can see for that University of Minnesota tuition bill, essentially the student will have to pay the amount below the red line that is still in that light blue color. The components in the yellow and the green will be paid by state grant and Pell Grant. You can see here we list what the averages are. Pell Grant, the maximum is $6,345. And then for the state grant, the maximum combined state grant and Pell Grant is $12,836. So that yellow bar is approximately $6,500 on average. For a student at Normandale, this is kind of what the chart looks like. So you can see the Pell Grant is essentially the same as it is for a four-year college student, but the state grant does shrink a little bit in response to that lower tuition level. And so the maximum combined Pell and state is $8,322, so about $2,000. And of course, once you add in the tuition fees, you can see that it falls for the lowest income families within the Pell and state grant range. So they are seeing 100% of average tuition fees covered by Pell Grants and state grants, up to approximately $50,000 of income for a dependent student. And this is what it would be at a state university. This is the average across state universities, and the Pell Grant is the same, but the state grant again moderates based on that differential cost. And for pretty much most of the state universities, it does fall within that 100% range, but only up to about $40,000 of income. It's a slightly lower income. This chart was put together by Ms. Whalen in our office. And essentially we wanted to make sure that it shows that whatever tuition fees that is not recognized within the state grant formula, it does automatically fall to the student and family to pay that. So there is a portion of cost that we're not showing you on most of the charts. If they attend an institution, typically a private institution that exceeds that maximum in law. Yeah. In terms of the state grant awards, this chart shows, because cost is differential within the program, you can see among students at two-year programs, 89% of recipients are at state colleges. And among funds that go to two-year programs, 88% of those state grant funds go to students at two-year colleges. On the next slide, you can-
Okay, just a minute, Ms. Fergus. We have to slow down here a little bit because I just want to, like, when you say 89 and 88%, it takes a little bit of people's time to, like, see what column you're at and stuff. So if you can help people understand, like, where you're referring to and just slow down a little bit so we can absorb the information, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Certainly, Madam Chair. So the first column on this chart is the number of recipients. So you can see Minnesota State Colleges had just over 35,000 students last year receiving a state grant. The second column will show you their combined Pell and state grant. So those students received just over or $139 million in combined. And then the last column is the dollar amount that's the total state grants paid out. So this chart is just students in programs of 2 years or less. And so that is where the 89% of recipients at two-year programs receive 88% of the funding. Yeah. The second half of the chart, this slide shows you the same thing, but apologies, the title is wrong. It's actually four-year program. Oh wait, the next slide, four-year programs. So you see here, these are students in the four-year programs, the first five lines. So among students in four-year programs, they're pretty evenly split between Minnesota State, the University of Minnesota, and private nonprofit institutions. And that's the 35%, the 30%, and the 34%. When you go over to the third column, you can see the split in terms of funds. That reflects some cost differentials because the state universities are the lower cost of those three groups. They receive 21% of state grant dollars, followed by the University of Minnesota and then the private colleges. Those two percentages, 37 and 42, represent the difference in the number of students. So you can see private colleges have about 4% or 4 percentage points more recipients and about 5 percentage points more dollars. So they're relatable. The bottom three lines are the totals for the chart. So all 2 years, all 4 years, and all the total across all programs. We get a lot of questions about the percentages on those two lines. And so we wanted to make sure we broke it out for you. This slide summarizes some of the changes that were in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021, which was passed by Congress. The largest thing is that it does include changes that relate to FAFSA simplification. Students and families will be asked to answer many fewer questions on the FAFSA. As I mentioned before, there's definitely fewer questions related to family assets, and so those will no longer be taken into account. In addition, that student aid index, which replaces the expected family contribution, will be based on poverty thresholds. So expected family contribution essentially was a tax on your income. So if you were a student and you earned $100, your EFC would be approximately 27 of those $100. So it was a 27% tax or assessment. The student aid index is moving to more of a poverty threshold, where based on your family size and your adjusted gross income, you would be assessed a certain amount. And so we're still trying to figure out what the implications are for state grant within that new change. And that is all I have for you today, Madam Chair. Apologies for starting your hearing by jumping into mathematical formulas and modeling, but I'm happy to answer any questions for you.
Representative Keeler. And thank you for your presentation, Ms. Fergus. And I'm guessing we're gonna have a lot of questions. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mrs. Ferguson. I have a question for you. I love data, so jumping into this isn't a problem, but I do wanna go back. I think it was the slide 16, 17, where we talked about where the distribution goes. From that, do we have a breakdown of academic flow? So do we know students who are utilizing the Pell to earn a two-year degree, do we know or do we follow them if they're going into four-year degrees, what the gap is in that? Because I also know with the six-year limitation, I think that we're creating an issue for people to maybe go on for master's degrees if we, you know, we're maxing out on that six-year limit. And so I'm just wondering if there's any data that maybe you could speak on now. If not, if you could send it to me later on that academic flow as to where people are ending up when they utilize the Pell.
Ms. Fergus.
Certainly, Madam Chair and Representative. So we can. We, through the data that the Office of Higher Education collects, we can definitely tell you what percentage of students in the two-year programs go on to transfer to a four-year. And to the extent that they utilize their state grant within those two, it might take us a little while to compile it because we haven't compiled in that fashion. The student, regardless of whether they attend a two-year or a four-year program, the lifetime limit on state grant is essentially 120 credits. And so they can take those credits part-time, so 3 credits per semester, full-time, 15 credits per semester. They could take 60 at the two-year college, another 60 at a four-year. I think the issue where students run out of state grant is more when they may need to require more than 60 credits to complete their degree. So for example, if they had taken some developmental education credits, or if they had changed majors and now had a couple more requirements to complete, that is where we find the third option would be if a program requires more than 120 credits to complete it at all. And some programs do require more than 120 credits. For Pell Grant, it
actually Representative Keeler, did you have
50 credits.
Sorry, Ms. Fergus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The limit on Pell Grants is actually 150 credits. So they do have an additional 30 credits of eligibility beyond state grant that they could maintain.
Representative Keeler.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just one follow-up. I do know that we see our transfer students have to take an increase in credits, especially if there's a gap in time frame. I mean, we know that credits expire sometimes. And so if somebody goes to school in their early 20s and gets an associate's and then comes back in their 30s for their bachelor's, we're seeing that they're having to have more credits. And so it is a concern of mine. I just wanna make sure that we continually think of the lifelong learner here and making sure that everybody has access to education. I appreciate it, and I would really like the follow-up data on that when you get a chance. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just meeting with the president of the Dakota County Technical College in Emperor Hills. And I was, could you help me or let us know, how does it work? He was talking about prisoners, people that were in jail that are taking classes. How does financial aid work with that population currently?
Ms. Fergus.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick. So prisoners, if they're currently incarcerated in a Minnesota facility, do have a slightly different state grant formula. They also some variations in terms of Pell Grants as well. But for the state grant portion, they essentially are not allowed to receive a grant to cover their living expenses because they're already in a Minnesota facility. And so their grants max out at tuition and fees. What that means is that depending upon the program that they're in, they may not always receive a state grant because of that lower cost basis. And so it is something that we too are concerned about and are looking to figure out how we can mediate it. And so, with the congressional changes, this is likely a time to revisit that issue.
Representative Kosnick? Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Vergas. As I was reading your grants, it appeared as if students had a responsibility of approximately half of the expected expenditures. Is that true for all students, regardless of family background or income?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative Sandell, yes. So the state grant was essentially created in 1983. And as such, it follows some pretty strict kind of finance principles. The first principle is that the student will receive a benefit from their education and therefore should have to pay a portion of the cost. And that benefit is received by all students, so it's applied against all students. Typically, it's considered what's to be a tax against their future income. What remains, though, is the tax on current income, which is essentially that family responsibility. And so for students who are independent, they actually end up paying both. And so we do have some concerns about affordability with related to that kind of multiple contribution scenario. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Fergus. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then I have one last question here that I just see there's no, no more hands up. At the last time you were here, there was some numbers that were shared with us regarding how many hours a student needs to work and at what wage level to be able to pay their individual responsibility. And it was like what a lot of us know anecdotally, like when we were younger, you could work part-time and pay your way through college sometimes on your own or with the help of parents and those sorts of things. And with some of the grants, do you have that information to share with us again, what it's like now and what a student has to do to help pay their way through college, if that's what they're trying to do, or what it was like before and, you know, how that's impacting students today.
Madam Chair, we do have that slide. I don't have it pulled up with me right now, but we can definitely, Ms. Oliver can definitely get that to you. So we encourage students to work because it's a means of engaging in their campus community. If they have on-campus jobs, they get to work with other students, meet with faculty, peers, and staff members. They integrate into that community, and that integration leads to a higher likelihood of college completion. The more people they know, the more likely they are to find resources, the more likely they are to stay in school and finish. However, there's a downside to working on campus, and that is if you have to work, be it on campus or off campus, at a high number of hours in order to pay your bills or your tuition and fees, then you might not have adequate time to study or to do other things to help you succeed academically. And so it's a balancing act. The research community in general feels that about 500 to 600 hours per year is the appropriate balance. And that works out to 10 to 12 hours per week. That is what they would like to see students engaged in. Yep. We are higher than that on average to pay the assigned student responsibility in Minnesota. I believe we're approximately 800 hours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Members, does anybody want to have a quick question before we move on? Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Burgess, for being here today. We appreciate your presentation, and also want to thank Ms. Oliver for being here today as well in the to be able to be available if people had questions as well. So thank you. We are now going to move on to the next part of our presentation, and that is with our the Minnesota Private College Council. And with us today, we will be having four presenters, and the first presenter starting with us will give us an overview of their legislative priorities this year, and we want to thank them for being here today. And Mr. Pulser Benick, if you could begin, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Paul Cirkvenick. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I'm going to share my screen for my presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify today. I'm joined by Gustavus President Becky Bergman, Hamline President Fainice Miller, and St. Scholastica President Barbara McDonald. For our testimony, I'm going to provide an overview about the collective impact of our colleges in the state and present our state grant request. And then our presidents are going to talk about the education we offer at our colleges and the importance of the state grant program. Our 17 members are private, nonprofit institutions. All are committed to providing a four-year liberal arts education. All have missions that serve a fundamentally public purpose, which I would summarize as providing high quality educational opportunities that prepare students for success in careers and in their lives and for service and leadership in their communities. Our colleges receive no state higher education appropriations for operating support or capital funding. Only a small share of the total state higher education budget, less than 4%, benefits our students who are eligible to directly receive need-based financial aid through the Minnesota State Grant Program. When most people think about private colleges, they think about the one or two small colleges they know something about. But our collective impact in Minnesota is significant. We serve 54,700 students, more than 39,000 undergraduates, and more than 15,000 graduate students. 32% of Minnesota high school graduates who pursue a bachelor's degree in Minnesota do so at our colleges. Our colleges contribute $1.6 billion annually to the state's economy and provide jobs for 14,000 employees, which makes our colleges collectively the ninth largest non-governmental employer in the state. We serve a diverse student population. 28% of our students are students of color or Native American. 23% are first generation students. 13% of students enroll part-time. 12% of our students are non-traditional, meaning age 25 or older, with most of those students enrolled in evening, weekend, and online degree completion programs offered by our institutions. And 21% of our new students each year are transfer students, with the largest share of our transfers into our colleges coming from the Minnesota Community Colleges. Our students reflect Minnesota. As students of color and Native American students have accounted for an increasing share of Minnesota's high school graduates, our first year classes have reflected these demographic changes. This fall, 31% of our first year students are students of color and Native American students, compared to 29% of last spring's Minnesota high school graduates who were students of color or Native American. And 27% of our students receive a Pell Grant. Pell Grants largely serve students from family incomes from families with incomes of under $50,000. Contrary to a common misperception about private colleges, our students, our institutions serve the same share of Pell Grant recipients as the Minnesota state system. A hallmark of our colleges is their high on-time graduation rates. Graduating on time is one of the best ways to hold down the cost of college and student debt. And graduating on time allows graduates to start their careers sooner. When compared to other private and public institutions on a state-by-state basis across the nation, our overall four-year graduation rate of 68% ranks second in the nation. Our four-year graduation rate for Pell Grant recipients of 55% ranks first in the nation. And our four-year graduation rate for students of color and Native American students of 56% ranks 10th in the nation. While Pell Grants and state grants are critical to ensuring access to four-year institutions for lower-income students, our institutions also work to keep college affordable. By awarding annually almost $700 million in institutional financial aid in the form of scholarships and need-based grants to students, we work to make college affordable for students from all income levels, including lower-income students. With institutional financial aid, 95% of our first-year students receive grants they don't have to pay back. And as a result, the average net tuition for first-year students, the average tuition price that students actually pay, is about $14,300 and is virtually the same as it was 10 years ago. When inflation is taken into account, average net tuition is actually $2,200 lower than 10 years ago. We know that student debt is a concern of students, families, and policymakers. It is also a deep concern of our institutions. 30% of our graduates have no student debt at all. The median debt for our graduates who borrow is $28,000. This is just a few thousand dollars more than the median at the four-year public institutions. For the median debt of $28,000, the typical monthly loan payment needed to fully repay a student loan in 10 years is about $280 per month. This is 8.2% of the median monthly earnings of new graduates. And as graduate earnings rise over time, student loan debt burden becomes an even smaller share of income. Most importantly, investing in an education at our colleges pays off. A study by the Georgetown Center for Education and the Workforce, which takes into account the actual costs students pay, determined that the ROI on a degree from our member institutions is more than $1 million over 40 years. The median annual earnings of our graduates working in Minnesota 5 years after graduation is nearly $60,000. Finally, the education we provide meets critical state needs. Annually, our colleges produce 29% of the four-year degrees and 46% of the master's degrees granted in the state. And as this slide shows, we produce a larger share of graduates educated in some of the most critical fields, including healthcare, education, and some of the STEM disciplines. Our legislative request is that the legislature provide a significant increase for the Minnesota State Grant Program. The State Grant Program, which accounts for about 13% of the state's higher education budget, provides need-based grants to low-income and middle-income Minnesota students to help them pay the tuition and living costs at Minnesota colleges, both public and private, and for all types of undergraduate degrees from certificates to bachelor's. As you just heard from the Office of Higher Education, the program's based on what's called a model of shared responsibility for the cost of a college education. There's a student share, a family share, and the share covered by Pell Grants and state grants. The program limits grants to students at our colleges to the same amount as they would receive if they were students at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. We ask that the state grant program be provided with funding increase of $67.5 million to reduce the student share from 50% to 47%. Madam Chair, as you recognized in your question about the student share, it's just simply not possible for students to pay that 50% share through reasonable student work and reasonable borrowing, and as the research has shown from the Office of Higher Education. When students work too much, it negatively impacts retention and graduation. And when the student share is too high, it puts pressure on students to borrow more than is ideal. Reducing the student share by 3 percentage points would increase the average state grant by $319. And for full-time students with the highest need, grants would increase by $500 to $770, thereby making college more affordable for low and middle income students. This change would also add 3,300 more students to the grant program, 70% of whom would be attending community colleges. Who benefits from the state grant program? 43% of all Minnesota students at Minnesota institutions receive a state grant. 56% of Minnesota students of color and Native American students receive a state grant. 64% of the funding in the grant program serves students at public institutions. And more than two-thirds of the recipients have family incomes below $50,000. This session, there is rightfully a focus on dealing with the impacts of the pandemic and with the large racial disparities facing our state. The pandemic has created a K-shaped economic recession in which, as the state economist has said, the impact has hit low-income families the hardest, disproportionately impacting people of color and Native Americans. Many students have lost their on or off-campus jobs. And for some, their parents have also lost jobs or lost income. These are the students who receive state grants and who most need additional help from the legislature. The pandemic's impact means the need to increase the state grant program is greater than ever. The pandemic has exacerbated the educational opportunity gaps for students of color and Native American students in Minnesota. And these disparities were already amongst the worst in the nation before the pandemic. Investing in a state grant program to lower the student share is a way to focus state resources on these, most directly on these two critical challenges. Increasing state grants will help address the opportunity gaps in Minnesota while preparing our workforce for the post-COVID economy. Madam Chair, that's the end of my testimony. I'm happy to answer questions or hand the testimony over to President Bergman.
Chair Bernardi, you're muted.
Thank you. I wanted to just say we have one member having their hand up right now, so we'll take that question. And then we'll move into the other three presenters, and then we will allow, we will have our members ask questions after that then. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I remember a couple of years ago, I was talking to a young woman that was getting ready to make a decision about college. And her family was there as well. And what she ended up doing, I believe, was going to St. Thomas, because overall it was cheap, less expensive for her to go to St. Thomas, which I consider a private college, versus going to a state college. And that kind of, at that point, I was pretty much astounded. And then the other thing, and if you want to comment on this, it seems that most of the colleges on your list are pretty much religious backing. So I'm wondering if that has anything to do with how you're able to accommodate your students, which I'm seeing is better than we're able to do at the state colleges. Thank you.
Mr. Stefanik.
Madam Chair and Representative Mason, thanks for the question. I would say a couple of things, and I hope maybe my presidents, either in their remarks or after their remarks, would also speak to your questions because they're good ones, and I know my presidents will have important things to say about them. I would say this. The marketplace for students among colleges is intensely competitive, and we are an unsubsidized sector, but we have to compete. And so we work very hard to offer a high quality education at a price that is affordable for every family. We try to meet every family where they're at. That doesn't mean every family pays the same price, but we work hard to make our educational opportunity within reach for all types of families. And you know, the great thing about Minnesota is we have a rich diversity of higher education institutions. And what the experts say is students do best when they find the institution that's the right fit for them. Our institutions are one opportunity and the right fit for many students, and we work really hard at making them affordable. To your question about our historical roots, I will say, many of our institutions were founded by immigrant communities through their churches. And most of them were founded before 1900 or before about 1920. And over time, they have grown into very diverse traditional liberal arts institutions. Our education at these institutions is non-denominational. Yes, we have a cultural tradition that comes out of particular perspectives, but we welcome students from all spiritual perspectives. And I'm going to stop there because I think our presidents are going to have maybe some really rich insights about who's attending our colleges today, that, you know, notwithstanding their historical roots.
Thank you very much. And we are going to proceed with the other three presidents that will be speaking, and then we will be moving to member questions. We have the president from Gustavus College. I want to welcome Becky Bergman and ask her to proceed with her testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Rebecca Bergman. Yes, I go by Becky. And I serve as the president of Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota. This is my seventh year as president of the college. I want to start by thanking the entire committee and the state of Minnesota for your leadership through this difficult time as we all continue to navigate the challenges associated with COVID-19, as well as the regular business that we operate within, such as the Minnesota State Grant. I also want to acknowledge and recognize that a number of the committee members are graduates of the Minnesota private colleges and universities, or have experiences within their family with the private liberal arts institutions that make up the MPCC. Gustavus is one of 17 of the liberal arts institutions that comprise the Minnesota Private College Council. We were founded in 1862, in our case, by Swedish Lutheran immigrants. And we have a strong foundational commitment to the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America and the tenets around education of that branch of the religious community within the state. That means that we emphasize inclusion, service to the community, and support for underrepresented and first generation students throughout the college's history. This is a tradition of ours, along with excellence in education, that we uphold. And yes, we welcome all students, of course. That is part of the Lutheran tenets as well, that we are welcoming to all. We offer students a variety of faith traditions as part of their wraparound student services here on campus. Our mission is central to us. In our particular mission, it calls us to offer students of high aspiration and promise a liberal arts education of recognized excellence. We aspire to be a community of persons from diverse backgrounds who respect and affirm the dignity of all people. Our overarching purpose is to help our students attain their full potential as persons, to develop in them a capacity and passion for lifelong learning, and to prepare them for fulfilling lives of leadership and service in society. Like all the private colleges in the Minnesota Private College Council, Gustavus emphasizes the student. We are student-centered in all aspects of their education, both in the classroom and all other parts of student life on our campus. We believe strongly in the value of a liberal arts education, preparing students to deal with complexity, diversity, and change throughout their chosen careers. We emphasize both the development of a broad knowledge about the wider world, as well as in-depth study in their chosen discipline. We know that our students will be entering a very complex world with many challenges. They are our future leaders in our communities and in our society, and we believe that our colleges prepare them exceptionally well for the challenges and opportunities that will lie ahead of them. One of our other big areas of focus this year has been diversity, equity, and inclusion education for all members of our community. We seek to actively participate in building a more just and inclusive world. As our state and country continue to confront these issues, we think this is an important area of learning for all of our students, faculty, and staff. Here at Gustavus, our spring semester began yesterday. We had a very successful fall and January term. We currently have approximately 2,100 students living and learning on our campus. We currently have 823 students who receive the Minnesota State Grant. This represents about 35% of our student body. As a result of this partnership and other sources of aid, the average net tuition cost for Gustavus students is approximately $21,500, and even considerably less for low-income students. We're proud that we can provide a high-quality education, small discussion-based classrooms, and high graduation rates at this cost. The Minnesota State Grant is an investment in the state's future. You know this. Gustavus, for example, has approximately 20,000 living alumni who live and work in Minnesota, contributing to their communities through their leadership, service, and tax contributions. The Minnesota State Grant Program serves as a catalyst to change the trajectory of the lives of economically disadvantaged young people in our state so that they can enter into higher paying jobs and subsequently give back to the state economy. On January 20th, some of the representatives here heard from one of our Gustavus students who does receive the Minnesota State Grant. Her name is Brenda DeRosas. She is a junior at Gustavus and comes from Albert Lea. She chose Gustavus because of its proximity to her family, its small discussion-based courses, and the supportive network here of faculty and fellow students. Brenda is a first-generation American and Minnesotan, a hard worker, and exactly the kind of student that our taxpayers should be proud to support throughout the Minnesota State Grant Program. I believe it is in the state's interest that the Minnesota private colleges and universities continue to thrive. Minnesota private colleges award approximately 30% of the bachelor's degrees in our state, compared to 33% at the University of Minnesota system and 33% for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. As Paul Cervenic mentioned, our institutions do this without receiving regular public funding, and we do greatly appreciate the Minnesota State grant funding that our students receive. Now more than ever, it is important that we continue to support students of high aspiration and promise as our institutions continue to deal with the pandemic and while also working to equip our students to graduate and serve their communities as well as the state of Minnesota. I'd like to close with a quote from Brenda DeRosas. Quote, This last year has made me really appreciate everything we have and the opportunities that are afforded to us at Gustavus. COVID-19 has made me realize how important it is to be surrounded by people who support me and who take care of one another, unquote. Chair Bernardi and members of the committee, I ask for your continued support of the Minnesota State Grant Program so that we at Gustavus and all the Minnesota private colleges can continue to take care of our students like Brenda. Thank you very much. I am now prepared to turn this over to President Fainese Miller, Chair Bernardi.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And now we will be moving, like you said, to the president of Hamline University, Fainese Miller. Welcome to the committee. You may proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair Bernardi.
Oh, we're not, oh, you're on. It accidentally went on mute, President Miller.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair Bernardi, Vice Chair Christensen, Ranking Member O'Neill, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I am Fainese Miller, and I have the honor of serving as president of Hamline University since 2015. Hamline's history is older than Minnesota itself, founded in 1854. We are the oldest operating university in Minnesota. While the University of Minnesota had its charter before Hamline, Hamline is the first institution in the state to enroll students. When we began educating students, Minnesota was still a territory rather than a state and wouldn't become a state for another 4 years. Among our first students and our first two graduates were women, which was highly unusual for that time. And this fact was the first step in creating what Hamline University is today, an inclusive university committed to virtue, equity, fairness, civic engagement, and academic excellence. I think the last issue of our alumni magazine said it best. Our cover read, Hamline University has a moral obligation to educate all. And unlike some definitions you may have heard along the way, for us, all really does mean all. You've heard about statistics about how MPCC schools help narrow the opportunity gap in our society. For the 2020 academic year, 52% of our incoming first-year class is made up of first-generation students. 42% of our total student body is first-generation. 47% of our first-year students are of color or Native American. And 39% of our total student body is of color or Native American. MPCC does a great job in highlighting how we, independent colleges and universities, perform in this area. But I'm happy to let you know that Hamline far exceeds many institutions in the state when it comes to enrolling students of color and Native Americans and first-generation students. We represent all of Minnesota. Why is this important? K through 12 has its goal to eliminate the achievement gap. We in the private colleges want to eliminate the opportunity gap. As we try to eliminate barriers to higher education in our society, we know that there are challenges for our students. Many of our students come from disadvantaged backgrounds. 47% of our first year students are eligible for Pell Grants. They are the people who need the state grant program the most. Now add the COVID-19 pandemic into the picture. Universities and students alike saw increased cost, reduced capacity for face-to-face instruction, and other burdens, emotional as well as financial. The result has been an even greater strain on institutions and students alike. Students, like those in Hamline, have been hard hit by the pandemic. We are here today to ask for your help. To ask for your help with all of our students. Funding the state grant program and decreasing the student share are both necessary steps to promote higher education in general and educational equity in particular, especially for those students who most need our help. And as we all know, these students contribute significantly to the state workforce and society in the future. Overall, 90% of our first-year students receive some form of financial aid from Hamline in the form of grants or scholarships. But to make this experience both valuable for the student and, more importantly, equitable for all who attend our institution, we need the help that the state grant program provides. You've heard the statistics already, so I will not repeat them. But the point I want to make to you this afternoon is that we have an opportunity in Minnesota to walk our talk in a very important way, to make it possible for those less financially able to get an education from one of our institutions and take advantage of opportunities that benefit us all. We were all awakened this past summer by George Floyd's death. We know how the state and nation reacted. But one of the real positives that came from a truly heartbreaking situation was a birth of a national sense, perhaps the greatest in my lifetime, of the opportunities marginalized members in our society face. All across the political spectrum, we saw elected officials take concrete steps toward equity, including those of you today. And we thank you. As one who lives firsthand the effects of differential treatment and understands what it means to be first generation, I would simply remind you that we as Minnesotans have the opportunity to address some of our more disparate issues by how and for whom we fund education. I ask you to keep the momentum going. Let us work together to provide the opportunities our students, our state, and our society needs. Together, we can address the issues our students face and help when and where we can. I firmly believe it is the right thing to do for all of our students, and I trust you agree. Many of you on this committee have studied or advanced your own education at private institutions, so you know what I'm talking about when I say that the MPCC education experience is special for our students. Academics, it's not just a word to us, it defines us. Civility is not just a word to us, we live it each day. And I'm most pleased to say that equity is not just a word to us. We try to embrace all that word entails every single day. Our student body is highly aware of the issues of the day, and regardless of their personal beliefs, they band together to help their fellow Pipers. Let me leave you with one example of what this means in practice. We all know the financial pressures college students face. That is the reason we are here in committee today. The Federal CARES Act, passed last year, allowed universities to make direct disbursements to students to recoup some financial losses caused by the pandemic. At Hamline, though, some of our students elected to take a higher road. Some of our students refused their CARES Act money and instead donated it to our Dean of Students Emergency Fund with the thought that there were Pipers who simply needed it more. Members of the community, I cannot think of a better group of people to support than these. Our students deserve the opportunity to receive an excellent education, to become leaders, and to work for change as they see it in the future. Students like those at Hamline University are one of the reasons I love Hamline University so much. And I ask you to help us help them through the state grant program. I now have the honor to introduce Dr. Barbara McDonald, president of the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Now with us, as mentioned, we have the president of the College of St. Scholastica. Welcome to the committee, Barbara McDonald.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Thank you very much for having me today. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share the Scholastica story with the committee members and echo many of the things my colleagues have said to you already today. I'd like to share my screen and a couple of slides that will better tell the story as I'm speaking to you. So if you could just bear with me, I'll do that now. Thank you for the opportunity to share the story of St. Scholastica with you. We're located in Duluth, Minnesota, on the shores of Lake Superior. Many of you have visited Duluth, I hope, and perhaps have seen our college on top of the hill. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the history of St. Scholastica and the mission that we carry. The College of St. Scholastica was founded in 1912 by the Sisters of the St. Scholastica Monastery. These sisters came to us from St. Joseph, Minnesota, and are part of the Benedictine tradition and heritage. Our college is grounded in the Catholic intellectual tradition, which really examines the intellectual capacities of faith and reason, and our students are shaped by that heritage. We stress intellectual and moral preparation for responsible living and meaningful work. We believe that we send students out, and our graduates and alumni are really out there to make a difference and transform the world. They have a very strong sense of social justice and of service to the community, and these are the hallmarks of the Benedictine heritage. Along with that are our five values of community, stewardship, respect, love of learning, and hospitality. And I mention those because these are the driving factors that our students leave with as they go out to serve the state of Minnesota. Many of you may also know that we have a presence across the state of Minnesota in St. Cloud. We're also embedded in several community colleges throughout the state, where we allow students to complete their four-year degrees by completing their third and fourth year on site. In this picture, you'll see the hallmark building of ours is the original building that was built by the sisters back in 2012 as the college opened its doors. This College of St. Scholastica has always been about access and opportunity, and it was first founded as a school for girls because there were no other options for education for young women. It eventually became a college of women, and in 1969 became co-educational. A little snapshot about our students, 78% of them actually are from the state of Minnesota, and we serve over 3,700 students, 2,244 traditional and non-traditional undergraduates, a third of which receive state grants. 18% of our students come from diverse backgrounds, 27% are first-generation students, and 100% of our students, Representative Mason was asking about what do we do as an institution to help support our students and their financial costs. 100% of our undergraduates receive financial assistance from the college. And as mentioned before, a large percentage of our students come from families with incomes less than $50,000. We're also a top-ranked military-friendly college. We are a yellow ribbon campus. And here in Duluth, we partner with the 148th Fighter Wing on trauma training and mentoring. We also embed our veterans cohort experiences and the local servicemen into our leadership programs, and in particular, our nursing major. My colleagues have mentioned the importance of equity, diversity, and inclusion. And like my colleagues, this is a very important aspect of the Benedictine heritage and our future. We have an inclusive excellence strategic plan that focuses on equity, diversity, and inclusion. And this is the backbone of our work, particularly these years, as we take a look at our students who come to us from very diverse backgrounds and very diverse needs. At St. Scholastica, we offer a four-year pledge that students can come here and complete in 4 years. We're the only Minnesota private college nationally recognized as an inaugural first forward cohort. This recognition recognizes a college that does exemplary work with first-generation students. Another thing we're proud about is being the number one college in Minnesota for overall economic mobility. This means that when students come to us and study with us and graduate, they're actually increasing their economic health and wellness of their families by 2 points on a scale of 1 through 5. We also host 5 TRIO programs on campus. And 98% of alumni survey respondents are employed or in graduate school within 6 months of graduation. And the majority of these folks are in healthcare and other professions. We are also very much about preparing Minnesota's workforce. Liberal arts is the foundation of all of our programs, and it's the underpinning for all 40 majors at the College of St. Scholastica. We also have the largest private school of nursing in the state of Minnesota, and we're second among all the colleges and universities in the state. Many of our health programs include health information management, health informatics, occupational health, physical therapy, physical assistant, and social work. And these programs are the ones that are most needed in the workforce in Minnesota. And we recognize that. All CSS nursing and health profession programs focus on preparing students for work in rural and underserved areas. We have strong partnerships with our healthcare industry partners in the area, and we do a lot of work to provide medical care professionals in greater rural Minnesota. We also offer clinics an OT and PT to underinsured and underinsured adults and children that have free access to these services at our Maurice's Clinic. A little bit more about our contributions to the region. You can see here that we're a large employer for the area of Duluth and that our economic impact is very strong, $220 million in a regional aspect. We have strong partnerships in healthcare, business, and education, and more than 8,000 of our students, alumni students, are in the nursing profession. And as you know, these folks are on the front lines of the pandemic. We're very, very proud of their work. 60% of all of our students major in nursing or other healthcare professions. Our faculty and staff and our students, as I mentioned earlier, are really focused on service. A large portion of the curriculum is experiential learning and engagement with the community to improve the lives of the community members. And finally, let me end with this wonderful slide with our students pictured on the state capitol stairs and just share a little bit about the state grant program with you at St. Scholastica. 900 of our undergraduates, a little over 30%, receive the Minnesota State Grant funding. The grant helps, as you know, low and middle income families at private and public colleges throughout the state. Before coming to the College of St. Scholastica, I served the Minnesota Public Schools, the Minnesota State College System for over 22 years. And students across the board at all of our colleges and universities have talked to me about the importance of the state grant. And it's just as important at St. Scholastica for the students that have these needs. The greatest investment that we can make is in our workforce. And I'm proud to say that 70% of our alum live and work in the state of Minnesota. As my colleagues have mentioned, the pandemic has affected many of our students, and we have been working closely with them to ensure that we can problem solve with them as their families have been impacted by the pandemic, their parents have lost their jobs, our students have lost their jobs too, and the community as places of employment have closed. And as you heard earlier, our students have also dedicated their dollars and time to help others out as well. This past year, our students dedicated $50,000 to help support an emergency funds for our students that were suffering from the COVID impact. So I just want to thank you all for supporting and strengthening this vital program. It's incredibly important to our students. And I'll close by saying that Shanti Cruz, who is the president of our Student Government Association, also shared with me that it would not be possible for her to become a social worker without the support of the state grant. And she wanted me to let you know that. So thank you very much, Chair Bernardi, for allowing me to provide these comments today. And I'll turn it back over to you. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation and to all our presenters today. We have a question from Representative Cleborne.
I was hoping I would be second. I would like to, one, thank you for the work that you do and for the support that you give to your students. I do want to have a robust private college system in Minnesota. And I know that COVID has been difficult for all of our institutions, and I'm sure it's impacting your donations and your families as well. So I want to start with that. The reason I raised my hand is when I hear the statement that our private colleges do not receive any direct funding from the state, it always makes me cringe, because you have, so this is not to the work that you're doing, it's just a statement about financing. The Minnesota private colleges are nonprofits. That is money that the tax exempt status that comes with that is money that the citizens of this state forego in collection. And it is money that our citizens give towards that mission of the work that you're doing, because we have determined in our state that it's important. So I don't want to take away from the really good things that you've said today, but I also want to acknowledge the contributions that the citizens of Minnesota make in the private colleges when they say you're a nonprofit and we are going to forego those tax collections. So it is a shared cost and a shared expense, and I just would like that to be acknowledged. Thank you.
Might I respond, please?
Let's see, President Miller, I believe, is that President Miller?
Yes, I just want to make one point that we really appreciate the support that we get in terms of taxpayer dollars. But I also want to point out that we're located in St. Paul, Minnesota, and Hamline University has invested significantly in the city. For example, the St. Paul State Stadium, Hamline University helped fund that stadium. The Trier Rink, Hamline University helped fund that Trier Rink. So, and we open our campus up to all of our members on the community. So we really appreciate that, but there's so much more that we do as well, and we give back to the community in very significant ways.
Chair Bernardi.
Representative Cleavorn.
I totally agree with you, and I would not take away anything from the work that you do and the membership and partnership that we have in our state. But that's just the point. It is a partnership. You don't do it alone, we don't do it alone. It's a partnership. And that's why I was hoping I wouldn't be first, because I don't want to take away from the valuable work that you do. But it is a partnership and we do it together. So I just want to make sure that we also recognize that as well. So that's just a comment, but I do greatly appreciate the work that you do and the partnership. And as your last president just said, it's a large employer in that community. Right? You have a lot of employees who generate a lot of revenue for the state. That's all great. But I'm just saying it is also a give and take. We help each other. Thank you.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, presenters, very much. I'm a little bit off topic here, but perhaps this is for Ms. Fergus or Mr. Sertfinick. But I'm just curious about, you listed all the nonprofit private colleges in the state. How many for-profit private colleges are there? You know, I'm just curious about that. I'm assuming that the state doesn't have anything to do with funding for-profit colleges, but, that's just a question I have, if anyone knows the answer to that.
I am thinking Ms. Fergus or Ms. Oliver, who would like to take that question? Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can take that question. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. So the number of for-profit, so for example, first we have to talk about what a for-profit college is in Minnesota. So many times when you use that term, we're thinking of for-profit colleges like the University of Phoenix, Walden University, Capella. However, it also includes most beauty schools. So Regency Beauty, now I'm blanking on the name of every beauty school in Minnesota. A lot of those private training providers that offer short-term credentials. And so in terms of the number of for-profit institutions we have, it's actually a high number, but the majority of those are those very short-term certificate type of programs. I do believe we have five universities that are for-profit, but I'll double check my numbers and get back to you, Representative Christensen.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and it's okay. I was just really curious about, so the big ones, University of Phoenix, Walden University, those are counted in there, but our state doesn't have anything to do with for-profit colleges, right, in terms of funding.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative Christensen, for-profit colleges are eligible for state financial aid, such as state grants, self-loans, if they do abide by the participation requirements. And so in terms of state grant, it does mean they have to send some data to our office and follow the rules about administering financial aid in general. New colleges who want to choose have to, they have to license and register with our office regardless of if they want to participate in financial aid if they're located in Minnesota. But they are given the same opportunity to participate as a private nonprofit college, but then they have to abide by the same kind of rules and regulations.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Bernardi, can I add something?
Yeah, Ms. Oliver.
For the record, my name is Nikki Oliver, and I'm the manager of Grants and Government Relations for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And I just want to add that we do regulate the for-profit institutions in the state. There are very few that actually participate in our state financial aid. I don't know if you all know this, but several of them have closed over the last 10 years for varying reasons. So there's not a ton, and I think in some of the charts that you've seen previously regarding state grant, there's a very small amount that are receiving state financial aid. So I just wanted to make that note.
Thank you very much. Members, are there any other questions of our presenters today? Okay, well, since there are no other questions, I wanted to give you a preview of our day tomorrow. We will be having the private colleges with us, the tribal colleges with us, Fond du Lac College, White Earth Tribal College, Red Lake Tribal College, Leech Lake Tribal College, and then we will also be having the inner faculty with us today, as well as the Minnesota State College faculty. So I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. I hope you have a good afternoon and evening. With that, the meeting is adjourned.